To hear the full episode, become a patron at patreon.com/deathpanelpod.
I'm Beatrice Adler-Bolton, and I'm here today with my co-host, Phil Rocco.
Hey.
And the two of us are really excited to be joined by law scholars Karen Tani and Katie Iyer to talk about their recent co-authored article published in the Yale Law Journal called Disability and the Ongoing Federalism Revolution, which is a groundbreaking look at a previously underexamined or, well, frankly, underrecognized role that major court cases on disability civil rights have played in shaping and enabling the contemporary conservative moment and the legal arguments conservatives have pursued to attack everything from worker protections for COVID, abortion, trans care, environmental policy, you name it. More specifically, the article explores the role that court cases involving disability played in laying the groundwork for a concept known as New Federalism. New Federalism is a political philosophy that in many ways is at the core of the contemporary conservative movement, whose focus is characterized by a no-holds-barred fight to restore power to the states by taking it away from the federal government. New Federalism as a political legal philosophy took hold in the context of backlash to the New Deal during the Nixon years, and in decades that followed, there is a second specific New Federalism-oriented legal movement that helps the Supreme Court to become the court as we know it, with the role and power it has in our current political economy. So our conversation is as much about disability law as it is about how competing ideologies of federalism have come to dominate politics. And this article not only presents a fascinating history, it also has important takeaways for so many interrelated struggles that many listeners are currently engaged in or thinking about. And today you're going to learn about it from our guests, and you're going to get a very special and rare chance to hear from Phil about federalism, which is an important aspect of his own research on the policymaking process and the political economy of policy expertise. And federalism, while it runs through everything that we talk about on Death Panel, rarely is actually the top line focus of episodes. So listeners, with what's ahead, you're actually in for a real treat. Now, without further belaboring the point, I'm really honored to welcome our two guests today, Karen Tani and Katie Iyer. First, Katie Iyer. Katie is a professor of law at Rutgers Law School. Her scholarship focuses on contemporary debates in anti-discrimination law and theory. Prior to entering academia, she litigated several precedent-setting decisions expanding the rights of LGBTQ and disabled employees, and is a leading expert on both employment rights and the relationship between social movements and constitutional change. Her 2019 article, Statutory Originalism and LGBT Rights, has been credited with originating the textualist argument that the Supreme Court adopted in the landmark case of Bostock versus Clayton County. This case, a 2020 United States Supreme Court civil rights decision, held that Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 protects employees against discrimination because of sexuality or gender identity. Katie, welcome to the Death Panel. It is so great to meet you, and I'm really excited to get to talk to you today.
Thank you. I'm really excited to be on the show today.
And next, we have Karen Tani. Karen is a professor at the University of Pennsylvania, jointly appointed in the History Department and the Law School. Her scholarship focuses on 20th century United States legal history, with particular emphasis on social welfare law and policy, disability, individual rights, and the administrative state. Tani is the author of States of Dependency, Welfare Rights, and American Governments, 1935 to 1972, from Cambridge University Press, which examines legal contests over welfare benefits and administration in the years between the New Deal and the welfare rights movement. Karen's current research project is about the legal and political salience of the concept of disability in late 20th century in realms spanning from social welfare, civil rights, to civil liberties. She is a dear friend of the panel, and we had the great honor of collaborating on a 7-part written symposium on the work of Marta Russell for LPE Blog. Karen, welcome back to the Death Panel. So wonderful to have you on the show.
Huge fan of the show, of course, and a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having us.
Thank you both so much for joining Phil and I today. Karen and Katie, to start us off, can you both set up for folks who haven't read your article and who maybe don't have background in federalism, what your co-authored research is about, what the pattern is that you both are documenting here, and what its significance is towards deepening an understanding of some of the dynamics that really permeate and shape legal decisions now in our current moment?
I'd be happy to kick us off. This is Karen, and I'll speak perhaps first to the historical piece of this, and maybe Katie will speak more to our observations about what's happening now and what we anticipate is going to happen going forward. So from a historical perspective, as you mentioned in your terrific intro, we are really interested in thinking about the how and the why of what legal scholars call the new federalism revolution. So a starting point here is just the Supreme Court plays a vital role in how we are governed, and it does that through its interpretation of the Constitution, its interpretation of major statutes, its creations of kind of canons of statutory interpretation, meaning kind of theories of how statutes are supposed to be interpreted. So with that backdrop, when the Supreme Court changes its tune in a major way, it's a big deal. And that's one way of thinking about what this new federalism revolution is. So B, as you said, it involves both the kind of amplification of state protective doctrines, and it also involves doctrines that tie the hands of Congress, specifically the U.S. Congress in particular ways. And we can elaborate on that more. So the conceit of the article is this new federalism revolution. Although there is tons of legal scholarship on this, scholars have actually missed a really important aspect, which is the role of disability-related cases in creating key pillars of this new federalism revolution. So the argument is not that disability cases are responsible for the whole thing. And as we'll talk about, there are kind of complex reasons for the new federalism. But our point is more about the kind of actual technical doctrinal construction of this revolution and how time after time, the conservative members of the Supreme Court in the 70s and 80s and 90s relied on disability cases to be sort of building blocks, often in ways that went unappreciated at the time and sometimes unappreciated by their more liberal colleagues on the court. And significantly, we show that they did not take very similar opportunities in cases involving other fact patterns. So, for example, cases involving race and sex sometimes set up virtually identical federalism questions. And in those cases, we show the court really did not try to make these same new federalism advancements. And so the arc of the article is to basically show time after time, it is disability cases doing this work. And maybe Katie wants to say more about how this pattern became entrenched and why it matters beyond the 70s and 80s.
I mean, I think first, just going back, I really want to stress just how moribund this set of federalism arguments is at the point of the history that we focus on, the set of disability cases that really revive this. So an important piece of the history here is the radical transformations in federal-state relations that happen with the New Deal, the federal government exercising much more power. And then sort of the cherry on top of that is, of course, Brown versus Board of Education and efforts of states to use federalism arguments to resist desegregation. So at right. the time we're entering at, in the early 1970s, this is just a really widely rejected set of arguments, and it has this real taint of racism attached to it. And so an important piece of what I think we're documenting is how disability just seemed a much more available path to for the justices who wanted to revive things like 11th Amendment immunity. And then as we trace in the piece, these are really the building blocks that become the much better known new federalism revolution of the 1990s and early 2000s. All of those cases couldn't have been decided as they were without the earlier openings that we document across this series of disability-related cases. And I think one of the sort of, for me, both most interesting and most concerning aspects of the piece is when you really do the deep dive here and trace this into the present, you can see essentially continuing trends into the present of disability cases that are now up before the Supreme Court being used to make novel federalism arguments today and that are sort of flying under the radar of many legal observers in a way that sort of more splashy issues might not be.
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing that it's funny, like intervening in this world, like writing about this stuff, you face this added burden, which is among all of the different topics in constitutional law, federalism, especially what you're talking about, is among the things that makes people's eyes glaze over, you know, the quickest.
So true.
And but the reality is, right, and the reason that this is important is this: it's really an argument about power, right? It's really a set of developments that relate to who is able to do what? What level of this state is able to exercise what kind of power over its people, over its subjects, right? And the thing that I think is fascinating is like the textbook version of all of this stuff completely leaves out not just disability, but it also leaves out this thing that you're talking about, which is the 11th Amendment. Like typically, like when I used to teach like a law and politics class, you're like, well, the Rehnquist Court comes along and then it says like, actually the 10th Amendment gives states way more power than we used to think that it did. And actually the Commerce Clause is not as expansive. It doesn't give Congress as much power as we used to think that it did. But in reality, there's this other really, really important feature of what we're talking about when we're talking about like power in the federal system, which is this thing called the 11th Amendment, which I would bet like most people don't really have a clear understanding of. And it's quite confusing, right? Because all of these cases that you're talking about are really about the conditions under which people can sue the state that they live in for denying it some kind of right, or for denying them some kinds of rights. But if, when you look back at the text of the 11th Amendment, it doesn't seem to say anything about that at all. It just seems to say that people who are citizens of another state can't sue a state in federal court. But all of these cases are about people who live in the state suing that state. So like, what is the 11th Amendment? Like, why is it so significant? And like, what's going on at this moment in time? Like, why is state sovereign immunity such an important feature of the contest over like who governs us?
Yeah, I'd be happy to read the boring, dry text of the 11th Amendment, first of all, just to reinforce your point, Bill, that it's not obvious that this should sort of be as important as it is in our lives. So it simply says the judicial power of the United States shall not be construed to extend to any suit in law or equity commenced or prosecuted against one of the United States by citizens of another state or by citizens or subjects of any foreign state. So the backstory of the 11th Amendment is that it becomes part of the Constitution in 1795 in response to a particular Supreme Court case that many people didn't like. So basically, a citizen of South Carolina had sued the state of Georgia in federal court, trying to collect some Revolutionary War debts. And the U.S. Supreme Court had said, sure, this is fine, right? And again, lots of people didn't like that. And the 11th Amendment put a stop to that. Now, what is interesting, again, not that you need to kind of revisit that dry text that I just read, but it's not clear that it means kind of more than the situation that I just described. And yet, roughly a century later, we get an important expansion. So in 1890, the Supreme Court interpreted the amendment to reach further so that it also covered suits against a state by that state's own citizens, right? So this is a really important part. So there's a kind of an expansion beyond the text that happens sort of post-Reconstruction. And then, you know, there's an interesting long stretch of time, and Katie alluded to this earlier, when actually, because of another case that I'll mention briefly called Ex parte Young, that expansion that I mentioned doesn't actually kind of mean that much. So in 1908, there's this case called Ex parte Young, and the Supreme Court in that case makes clear that litigants are allowed to use the federal courts to enforce the U.S. Constitution against state officials that are acting contrary to the Constitution. And in practice, what you need to know is that this interpretation opened up a lot of space for people to hold states to account in federal court. Now, just to elaborate on why this matters, right? I think we all know that state officials are often the ones with the most kind of meaningful contact with citizens and the most ability to kind of make their rights real or make their rights unvindicated or even violated. So it's very important that somebody would have the ability to reach those state officials. And moreover, access to federal court has traditionally been seen as a place where you would have a better chance of doing that, of holding state officials accountable. So that's kind of the backstory with the 11th Amendment. Katie, do you want to say something, anything more about its role in governance or the way it was interpreted over time?
Yeah, I mean, just a couple of things. I mean, I think, first of all, many, you know, don't understand the powerful role that the 11th Amendment can and does play in preventing people from accessing what they think of as federally guaranteed rights. So the 11th Amendment, especially in combination with other complicated federal courts doctrines, can effectively mean that people who have rights on the books don't have an effective way of enforcing them. Certainly don't have an effective way of, for example, getting damages for an experience that might have harmed them, but sometimes in conjunction with other limitations may foreclose any relief altogether. The other thing that I think is really fascinating about all this is that, of course, as you alluded to at the outset, right, we've got an interpretation of the law here that is clearly inconsistent with the language of the amendment. And during the New Federalism Revolution, core components of the majority here are folks who style themselves as textualists, and thus you would think would not be receptive to this. And so one of the more interesting things that we trace in the paper is that there is this sort of moment when Justice Scalia, who is the sort of best known textualist, comes to the court where he sort of questions whether or not he should adopt this contra-textual interpretation. It looks like there's this moment where he might go with the progressives on the court and say, this is actually inconsistent with what the Constitution requires. But then as we show, it's in part the real weight of the modern disability cases that persuades him that he should not walk back this then, you know, sort of 80-year-old interpretation.
So, yeah, I mean, let's get into the kind of details, right? We're talking about the early 70s, and we're talking about some pretty important justices in like the history of the conservative legal movement, William Rehnquist and you know, initially Lewis Powell. Like, who are these people? What are they bringing to the table in the 70s? Because one of the things that's cool about the article is you guys actually like get into the things that are typically hidden from public view about how the court makes these decisions. So like, why is this so important to them? And like, where does disability come in? Why is disability law so critical to this like development?
To hear the full episode, become a patron at patreon.com/deathpanelpod. You'll get access to this and the rest of our catalog of patron-only episodes, and be the first to get a new patron episode every Monday when it drops. With love, the Death Panel.